Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 063091, United States of America versus Edmund Spencer Appellant. Ms. Dyer, appellant, Mr. Price for the appellate.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And may it please the court. Beverly Dyer on behalf of Emmett Spencer. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case involves a search at Mr. Spencer's residence based on the following facts. Police officers watch Mr. Spencer play chess inside a carryout for 2.5 hours. During that time, he goes to his car a couple of times, but the police see no transactions or other suspicious behavior. The police ask him to leave the carryout, and they watch as he drives away in his car. Some seconds or moments later, he picks up a rear seat passenger. The police, Pamela Williams is that passenger. The police execute a traffic stop because the license plates do not match his car. And after they signal for the stop, Ms. Williams makes tucking motions in the rear seat in the same spot where the police later find 70 bags of heroin. Mr. Spencer, at the time of the spot, has $99 in cash in his hand. The police later learn that he was picked up less than 2 months earlier for simple possession of heroin. At most, these facts suggest that Mr.
Spencer... He had two bags in his pocket, too, right? Empty
they
plastic
were empty.
Bags. And then there's a bag of heroin in the glove compartment, too.
There's a bag of heroin in the glove compartment with a small amount of drugs, all of which suggest personal use.
In your recitation of the facts, wasn't there also a front seat passenger during part of this?
There was apparently a front seat passenger who was in the car with him either before he drove off or shortly thereafter when he moved to the other side of the street, and she got out at some point when the police did not see them. So the officer who testified at the Superior Court hearing said that at one point he lost sight of the car for about 40 seconds.
Wasn't there also, maybe that's the person you're just talking about, wasn't there a third person who got in and out of the car?
Yes, and then there is another woman.
Why isn't that consistent with trafficking?
With a traffic stop or with
trafficking drugs? That's a basis. Maybe they sold her drugs.
To the second person as well as the third person?
Yeah.
Well, it's unlikely that somebody who is selling drives around in their car. It's more likely that they stand on a corner and that somebody buying drives by and picks them up to purchase drugs from them.
Well, you just said more likely.
I think it's typical in street-level sales of heroin for people to have established corners. Someone driving around in their car might get in the way of somebody else, invade in the turf of a street-level seller who's standing on the corner. I think the fact that he picked up somebody in his car makes it much more likely that he was about to purchase drugs than that he was.
But this might have been a reason for the magistrate not to issue the warrant in the first place, but obviously our standard of review under Leon is far different.
Well, the standard of review under Leon should look at the facts that the police officers omitted from the original warrant. And I want to be clear that we do contest the omission of the facts from the warrant affidavit at the beginning, as well as the failure to update.
Was that properly raised in the district court?
It was properly raised, and the district court ruled in two ways against us that precluded reopening the suppression hearing, one of which we did not clearly state in our briefs, but the district court ruled that Leon does not apply to omissions at page 62 of the suppression transcript. And then just after that, the court also ruled that the defendant could come back to reopen with the Superior Court transcript if Officer Smith was present at the Superior Court hearing. That ruling effectively denied or rejected the defendant's argument that the knowledge of the officers should be imputed to each other. They were all within the Fourth District. They were all working on this case. So that the defendant clearly made the argument that there might be omissions in the Superior Court transcript that would be relevant, and that the findings of the Superior Court were relevant to whether the officers should have actually executed the warrant or had a good faith basis that there was probable cause to find drugs in Mr. Spencer's residence. So there's the omission were rejected. The fact that Leon applies at all to omissions, the district court said Leon does not apply to omissions. It applies to false statements or reckless disregard for the truth. And then the court went on to say, and you can come back if Officer Smith was present at the hearing, but otherwise I find that you have not shown any basis on which to not find good faith. And then the Superior Court transcript revealed, for the first time at least to us, that there was a failure of the police to state that the bags, that Ms. Williams actually tucked the 70 bags of heroin, that she had them physically in her possession. That fact would
the affidavit seeking the warrant said that the bags were on the back seat next to her.
They said that they didn't say next to her. They said found in the rear seat area.
Well,
and they said that she made tucking motions.
Right. And so this just added that. What did this add to that?
This added that she tucked the 70 bags, in fact. She could have been tucking one of the other bags found in the rear seat.
Right.
So she could have been tucking anything. She could have been moving her hands around. But the fact that the bag of 70 bags was found exactly where she made
tucking
motions.
But is that inconsistent with the other reasonable possible interpretation that, you know, they were working together to sell drugs from the car?
There is no fact in the record in any place suggesting that they actually were working together. And the other...
they were in the car.
Even if that were reasonable at the point of the arrest, which we contest, once they knew that she had the 70 bags in her possession, it was no longer reasonable after the Superior Court made a finding to hold her and not him for possession of the 70 bags. That ruling by the Superior Court and that knowledge that she was tucking the 70 bags defeats the government's argument that Pringle applies to this case.
Mm-hmm.
Because even in Pringle, once the defendant in Pringle acknowledged that the drugs were his and that they were not the possession of the other occupants, the police let the other occupants, including the driver and owner of the car, let them go. So therefore, once the officers knew that the Superior Court was not going to hold Mr. Spencer.
Well, Investigator Smith didn't know that, right?
Well, I find it hard to believe that there was not knowledge amongst one of the eight officers who executed the search warrant. There were at least eight officers present at the time that the search warrant of the house was executed. And there was a lot of talk within the 4th District about this case. There was a lot of planning for this. They went and got an arrest warrant on January 6th. So between January 2nd, when the Superior Court dismissed the charges, and January 9th, when they executed the warrant, they went and got an arrest warrant based on a domestic violence incident 3 months earlier.
Was there an estoppel effect from the dismissal of the charges?
I don't think there's a legal estoppel effect, but I think it does go to factually whether the officers had a reasonable
basis. Well, it's different
basis.
Than newly discovered facts, for sure.
It's different from newly discovered facts, although, from our perspective, the fact that she was tucking the bags is somewhat newly discovered. I understand that Officer Jones and Officer Womack would have known that. At least Officer Jones would have known that before Smith prepared the affidavit. So that the omission, there was an omission at the time of the affidavit, and there was an omission later in the failure to update. But I think the Superior Court finding, the ruling itself, is relevant to whether Pringle still has any application at the time that the warrant is executed. We know there's a lot of talk. We know there's eight officers involved in executing the warrant in the same district. So we know that at least there's a lot of, there must be some back and forth. It seems implausible that officers executing the warrant would not want to know whether Mr. Spencer was still in custody and whether, for example, he might actually be at home when they executed the warrant, so that they would not find out whether or not he had continued to be held in Superior Court on the original charges. So there are a number of reasons in which that suggest that the knowledge should be imputed to Officer Smith. And at the time of the preparation of the original affidavit, he got his information from Officer Womack. There's only three officers present who would have known this information: Smith, Womack, and Jones. One of them neglected to put the full story before the original judge who signed the warrant. So that omission was clearly material to whether or not Williams, rather than Spencer, was responsible for possession of those 70 bags.
I take it you don't think the Frank test applies?
Frank's
and why wouldn't it?
I think Frank's may apply if we need additional facts, if we need to actually create a better record than we have from the Superior Court transcript. And that might be relevant to a court deciding this issue, whether or not, you know, it might be important to flesh out some of the information that was present at the time within the 4th District. What kind of talk was going on, for example? What did a lot of talk mean? But the district court's ruling that Leon does not apply to omissions precluded the defense counsel from coming back once he had the Superior Court transcript and asking the court to reopen the case. So there was no basis. After the district court made that ruling, then there was no basis unless the counsel came back and asked the court to consider that ruling, but that would not be based on any new facts. Okay. Counsel had already made the argument very clearly that there might be omissions in the Superior Court transcript that would be relevant.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, and may it please the court, my name is Matthew Price on behalf of the United States. The affidavit established a fair probability that evidence of drug activity would be found at appellant's residence. The search warrant was therefore lawfully issued, and nothing that happened at the Superior Court changes that analysis. The affidavit established a substantial basis for thinking that appellant was involved in drug distribution and was more than a mere purchaser. First, drugs were found all over the car, not only in the back seat, but also in the glove compartment to which the backseat passenger did not have access. Second, in appellant's pockets were two empty distribution-sized bags with a distinctive logo that matched the bag in the back seat that contained 70 smaller individual drug doses.
Do you think the police can always get a warrant to search someone's home when they find someone with drugs?
Well, I think there needs to be in the warrant a statement of training and experience, which there was in this case, explaining that drug dealers...
Why does that matter? I mean, it's just kind of common sense, right? I don't know what the expert opinion is that someone's likely to have something at home if they have drugs in a car. But in any event, are you asking for a per se rule here?
Well, we don't think it's a per se rule in the sense that the magistrate still needs to make the magistrate's own independent and detached judgment about whether the officer's statement of training and experience is connected to the circumstances of the case. So there still needs to be some sort of intermediate decision by the
officer. Well, every officer is going to have the training and experience to know that someone with a certain quantity of drugs may well have additional materials at home. Right? I mean, is any officer not going to have that training and experience?
Well, one can imagine a new officer who doesn't have any experience at all not having that training and experience. I mean, in this case, the affiant was someone who had attended the MPD's narcotics courses, who had been trained in street-level drug investigations, who had participated in hundreds of drug arrests in Washington. And so the statement of training and experience here is quite robust, I think.
Do you think that U.S. v. Thomas establishes a bright-line test? A per se test?
I think U.S. v. Thomas does say that, yes, when there is a statement of training experience.
So your answer to Judge Kavanaugh is yes, there is a per se rule in this circuit, right?
I think there's a per se rule that if there is such a training, there is a substantial basis for the magistrate to find probable cause, yes. And indeed, that conclusion accords with decisions of other circuits. Indeed, the Seventh and Ninth Circuit don't require a statement of training and experience at all, and the magistrate is simply entitled to draw a reasonable inference that people who are drug dealers often keep evidence of drug dealing in their houses. So it's quite a common inference to draw among circuit courts. Just to return to other reasons why we think that there's a good reason to think that appellant was more than a mere purchaser here, in addition to the drugs found in the glove compartment and the bags, distribution-sized bags in his pocket, that morning he was seen going back and forth to his car several times, which is suspicious behavior in a high drug area. He also had a prior conviction for drug distribution, which we think is relevant. He was holding a large amount of cash proceeds in his hand.
What do you think about counsel's argument that Pringle is different because there was no... None of the people in the car exercised any, it gave no indication of any control of the drug. So the court could conclude there that, you know, it could have been any, they could have all, could have been any one of them. Whereas here you have this furtive gesture.
Well, we don't think Pringle is different. In Pringle, the drugs were found in the backseat.
Well, no, but that's a difference right there. Why isn't that a difference? That there was none of the passengers of the car in Pringle indicated any control over the drugs. That's the argument.
Well, it's true that in this case the backseat passenger was tucking the drugs.
Right.
But,
That didn't happen in Pringle.
That's right, but what the reasoning that Pringle rested upon was that when two people are found in a car with drugs, it's a fair with distribution quantities of drugs, it's a fair inference that they're involved in
drug
distribution.
Right, but the court expressly said that the court expressly said that all three, quote, failed to offer any information regarding the ownership of the drugs. I mean, the court expressly stated that.
Well, we don't think the fact that she was tucking the drugs in the back seat indicated her ownership of the drugs. We think that she and Mr. Spencer jointly possessed the drugs, and they were involved in the drug distribution scheme together. And there's plenty of other evidence in the affidavit, such as the evidence that I was just mentioning, that supports that theory of the case.
Is there any information about the approximate value of the drugs in the car?
There's no evidence in the record as to that, no. Indeed, you know, if appellant's theory of the case were right, it's hard to explain why there would be drugs in the glove compartment if Mr. Spencer were simply going to buy a small amount for his personal use. There are already drugs in the car that he could have used. And it's also hard
to... And the bags.
I'm sorry?
And the plastic bags in his pocket.
And the plastic bags in his pocket, which were distribution-sized, I might add. They were medium-sized plastic bags of the kind that were used to contain, 70 small Ziploc bags. And so we think that that's very hard to explain on appellant's theory.
The affiant here presumably did not know that the court had dismissed the charge as against Mr. Spencer. Would that information have made a difference if the officers did know?
We don't think so, because we don't think the fact of we don't think the dismissal was a fact at all that needed to be presented to the magistrate who issued the warrant. And we also don't think, in any event, that it's a material occurrence. The magistrate who receives an affidavit needs to make his own independent, detached judgment about whether that affidavit supports probable cause. And the fact that another judge in a detention hearing reached a different conclusion regarding those facts is not a reason for the magistrate to reconsider his own conclusion when he had already considered the evidence in the affidavit and concluded that there was indeed probable cause. So we don't think that the fact of the dismissal would have been material to the magistrate's consideration. Additionally, we think that the fact of the dismissal is governed by Franks, and other circuits have held that when there's when facts occur after a warrant has been issued, the question of whether the affiant needs to return to the magistrate with that information is indeed governed by Franks. And Franks requires not only...
This is an argument even assuming we consider it a fact, right?
That's correct. Well, Franks requires first that there be facts.
Right.
Second, Franks requires that the fact be material, which I've just discussed. But third, Franks also requires a reckless or deliberate omission. And here there's been no evidence whatsoever, and indeed not even an assertion until the reply brief, that the failure to return was reckless or deliberate. The appellant never requested a Franks hearing, never attempted to develop evidence of reckless omission. And we think it's too late in the day now for that argument to be made. There's simply an absence of evidence on that point. If I may, I'd like to discuss the three other omissions that appellant alleges from the search warrant. These two are governed by the Franks analysis, but we think that argument is waived. And we direct the court's attention to pages 56 and 57 of the May 11, 2004 transcript. This is the district court's suppression hearing transcript. Defense counsel says, "The government notes in its opposition that we have not articulated any misstatement of the facts or omissions with respect to information that the officer had at the time he prepared the affidavit. I did order the preliminary hearing transcript in the Superior Court to see what, if anything, the officer testified to. We have not been able to get it. At this time, I don't have any information any misstatements were made, but if in the future I learn after we get this transcript, skipping down now, I want to reserve the right if I learn of some difference there." And the court responds, "Right reserved." Yet appellant, after receiving the transcript, never went back to the district court to present the district court with the omissions that appellant now alleges, and we think it's too late in the day for appellant to do that now. Even if you were to consider that argument, however, we do think those facts were not material, nor is there ever any evidence whatsoever of their reckless or deliberate omission.
On Thomas, can I ask you one question? Your opposing counsel says Thomas should be limited to ongoing activity. Can you respond to that?
This case did involve ongoing activity in the sense that
Now, as compared to one-time activity.
As compared to one-time activity. Well, I think there's no reason to think that, first of all, there's no reason to think that this case involves a one-time activity as opposed to ongoing activity. All the evidence points in favor of the backseat passenger and Mr. Spencer being involved together in a drug distribution scheme, which implies ongoing activity. And second, people typically don't distribute drugs just once. People who are involved in the distribution of drugs make it their business, and we think if they just happen to be caught doing it once, that should be enough to justify a search of their residence based on an officer's statement of training experience that such individuals are likely to keep evidence of their drug dealing in their homes. If there are no further questions, we ask this court to affirm.
Thank you. Does Ms. Dyer, I don't think she's no time left, right? Ms. Dyer, you can take 2 minutes if you'd like it.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I would like to point out that we did argue in our opening brief that the officers were reckless on page 16.
You argued what?
We argued in our opening brief that the officers were reckless on page 16. Mm-hmm. I'd also like to point out in response to the government's argument that while the district court did say right reserved at the quotes that the government was citing, the court's later ruling that Leon does not apply to omissions overrode that ruling. And the later ruling would be controlling, typically. So,
well, you could have asked the court to reconsider. You
could have asked the court to reconsider that, but that's not the same as asking based on newly discovered information from the Superior Court transcript. Typically, courts don't. Asking courts to reconsider their legal rulings is less usual or less frequent than asking them to reopen a suppression hearing based on new evidence. I would reiterate that the government has pointed out no evidence, no fact that suggests joint possession here. There's nothing specifically in the record that indicates that they were acting together.
They're in the car together.
They're in the car together, but he picks her up after he gets in the car. So she's somewhere on the street. How does he know that she's there? He's playing chess for 2.5 hours.
Well, playing chess is not inconsistent with being a drug dealer.
But he's not going to his car and doing anything that they see suspicious. They're watching him the entire time. He's doing things that are much more consistent with a drug user. He may be going to the car to get drugs. The drugs in the glove compartment are small, and
what about the bags in the pocket?
The bags in the pocket are empty.
I understand, but they're the same bags, right?
Well, they're the same bags, but he may buy them. He's got $99. That could be enough to buy 10 bags. The bags,
he's buying empty bags?
No. I'm just suggesting he's used whatever was in the bags.
Okay.
He's holding the amount consistent with an amount to buy some supply for personal use.
Okay. Thank you. Your time
Thank
is
you very up. Much.
The case is submitted. Thank you both.